This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the September 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is The Snow Coil by George and Meredith Guthridge. My father's mukluks, which I had stuffed with grass and hung by a leather strip from a rafter of our hut, had not stopped swinging. For 44 days since father had first become lost out on the ice, the boots had not stopped moving. They turned and swung so slowly you had to stare at them a long time, even though the other villagers had decided he was dead. As long as the boots kept moving, he was alive somewhere. The hut was very cold. Frost furred the ceiling and ice coated the seal gut window. Unlike the Kaskig, the men's house, the hut was not heated, even in winter. Only women and children slept in the huts. I had not slept in the hut for 6 months until last night, when the lights of the aurora had broken the heavens into ribbons of green and gold. Ghosts rode those northern lights, so I had returned home from the Kaskig to make sure mother was safe. I now sat watching her soap her hair in the urine basin. She had pulled back the hood of her parka, and her face looked broad and very brown above the hood's wolverine fur. It hurt me, knowing how much I missed living with her. Being a man and sleeping in the Kaskig was not the total joy I had once thought it would be. She looked at me as she continued massaging and shampooing her scalp. She smiled. I gazed at the earth floor. "I know you feel I should not be washing," she said, "but life must go on, Palooknak." She knelt before the water pot and, using the ladle's ivory handle to break through the ice that had formed, rinsed her hair. "People are like grass," she said. "The older ones die, and others after them take their place." "Father was not old," I said. "No, but he was a hunter. The best hunter." Again she smiled. It was a sad smile, full of love. "Yes, Palooknak, he was the best." She glanced uneasily at the mukluks. "Is the best," she corrected. She toweled her hair with a piece of tan hide. "And for hunters, death is always close. That is why it is so hard out on the ice. Death sometimes comes disguised as a friend." I said nothing. For our people, silence is more meaningful than words. I picked up my spear and started sharpening the ivory tip with a stone, working slowly so she would know I was listening. "He's been more than a hunter and provider," she went on. "Do you remember how he'd sit for hours, me in front of him with my back to him, and search my hair for lice? I'd fall asleep beneath his gentle touch. That's your father, gentle and strong." She put down the tan hide and stood looking up towards the sunlight, seeping through the seal gut window. "Leave me now, Palooknak," she said huskily. "The morning is full of memories." I went outside. The wind was up, the ocean currents running towards the northwest, so there wasn't any sense in the men putting out the boats today. The ice had caved away from the shore and floated like a great white ridge along the horizon. Down on the beach, some children were playing among the snowdrifts, tossing a sealskin ball back and forth, while a couple of dogs yelped and scurried in vain to steal it. The scene depressed me. How could they be so happy and carefree while father was still missing? "Palooknak," said a voice behind me, "come quickly." I turned, startled. It was Angamachik, the dirty-faced orphan boy our village shaman had adopted before the shaman, like father, had been lost out on the ice. Angamachik's eyes peered at me from deep within the hood, of his spotted seal parka. His gaze, dark and charged with power, penetrated me. I started to step back and lower my eyes, but stopped myself, showing fear before a magician's adopted son can be very bad. "The ox crazy dance again," he said, his voice flat and emotionless. Then he turned and, motioning for me to follow, began threading between the huts and snow-covered boulders of our village. We went partway up the mountain that is our island, then along the cliff face to the north slope, where the ox nest among the rocks. The air was alive with their cawing and squabbling. In dismay, we watched several of the great gray birds swoop down from the heights, suddenly tuck in their wings and tumble towards the sea, then check their fall when they were just above the waves and soar upward. What might make them act so strangely, I could not guess. "One of these times, they will be unable to stop their dives," Angamachik said. "They will tumble into the sea and snap their necks on the breakers." "You know this to be true?"
"I know."
And again, his eyes burned. "Something has tilted the world out of balance, Palooknak, and the birds have sensed its tipping. They tumble to free themselves from that terror, but soon their wings shall tire. They bear the burden of oncoming disaster." Folding the bulky arms of his parka, he scowled, and his eyes gleamed angrily as he gazed back towards the village. I, too, sensed something terrible as approaching, but the others seem not to notice or care. He nodded towards the cliff. "The signs are everywhere, here with the ox. And remember those pebble-crusted salmon Kipnuk found in the belly of that beluga whale he harpooned? And lately, the auroras, yes, the auroras, stand outside and whistle in mockery during a light storm, and those ghost lights may fly down and cut off your head." The sky had been wild with them the night after Father had gone out onto the ice to hunt walrus and had not returned. Since then, the auroras have danced ever brighter and more terrifying. "Why will they not listen to me, Palooknak?" Angamachik's voice, usually so cold and quiet, suddenly sounded shrill. "Can they not feel that calamity is about to occur? Do they not remember that if the earth tips too much, the daylight will wash back into the sun and never again flood forth?" I looked into the dark recess of his hood and saw a face filled with fear. "They are fools," he said. "Were you already a shaman, they would heed your warnings." "I am a shaman's son." "If only Father were here. He respected you. He would listen. Then they'd listen." "Your father is dead, Palooknak. Stop dwelling on the past. Help the living." "He lives. His mukluks say so." "The mukluks lie. The wind moves them, nothing more. Your house is drafty." I shook my head. "Father and I chinked the walls last summer, every crack stuffed with grass and mud." He took hold of my shoulders and looked at me sadly. His eyes were those of a friend. "The wind," he said. When Angamachik's father, the shaman, had disappeared, we also had hung mukluks. The shaman's boots had stopped swinging the next morning, dead. "No one has lasted out on the ice more than 5 or 6 days," Angamachik said. 44 days? No, impossible. Accept it, Palooknak." I did not reply. I looked away towards the sea. Then I saw the boat. It was small and dark, moving between a break in the ridged ice. I raced down the slope to the shore and, shielding my eyes with my mittened hand, squinted against the glare of sunlight upon the water. The boat grew larger and larger. "Too big for a kayak," I said, as Angamachik came up alongside me. "It's not of any sort I've seen before," he said. "An Umiak? From one of the mainland villages? You see?" I pointed. "Several rowers are aboard. Perhaps they're bringing father back." "The bow's too narrow for the boat to be an Umiak," he said. Then his voice chilled. "A dog creature's boat." My heart stopped for an instant, then began pounding. The terror I felt must have been the same the ox had known. Onward and onward the boat came, and now our people spilled from their huts and ran along the slope to the north shore. Word of the alien boat had spread unspoken like a wind. None of us had ever seen one of the white men who hunted whales and walrus and who sometimes visited mainland villages. But ideas abounded concerning their origin. Most, like Angamachik said, they were the offspring of evil people who had married with dogs. Some, like Father, suggested they were men like ourselves, except that the warm seas of the south had bleached away their natural color. Whatever the case, their presence had been like a nightmare retold by its dreamer, interesting and amusing, but only slightly frightening, until now. The other villagers gathered around us. Mother looked at me, and I put my hand on her sleeve to steady her. I hoped she would not notice that I, too, was trembling. A man stood up in the bow as the boat nosed towards the shore. "I am Keiko," he shouted, "from the village of Anakark. I bring white friends come to trade." As the bow nudged the shore, the steersman stood and moved forward between the rowers. He stepped around the one called Keiko, jumped onto the snow, and pulled the boat up. Then, lowering his parka hood, he turned and faced us, grinning. Even his eyes seemed to grin. Almost as one person, we gasped and stepped back. His skin, pasty-looking, was pale as death. His hairy chin indeed resembled the jowls of a dog. "This man is called Captain," said Keiko as he climbed down. "Beyond the ice, he commands a boat as big as five houses with sails the size of mountains." He helped the rowers unload several bundles. The men opened the blankets and lay items upon the snow. "Captain brings flour and metal knives and trade goods from hot weather islands to the south," Keiko went on, beaming with pride. Our people looked at the fat and glittering gifts upon the snow, then rushed to the village to gather things of equal value. Captain, however, turned out not to be interested in our spears and harpoons and fish hooks and nets of the island's finest fibers. Keiko set us back for ivory and furs, less precious things certainly, but items we would need for hunting and for winter. I too traded, and foolishly. My fox skins went for dance beads for Mother. My ivory for something Keiko called banana. Its skin tasted horrible, but I ate it anyway. I gave my only polar bear hide for mirror, which captured my face each time I looked at it. During the trade, I imagined I could somehow use mirror to capture foxes and wolves as it had captured me, but I immediately realized the idea was childish. The excitement of trading and the fear of the white men had stolen my reason. Others also traded poorly, some for matches, which worked only once, some for salt, which proved to be but the sea without water. Some gave all their furs for sacks called flowers. They dumped out the white stuffing within the sacks and went happily home. Only later did we learn that the stuffing, now blown away by the wind, was the flowers, which, mixed with water, could be cooked and eaten. Evening came early, cloudy but calm. After I hid Mirror in the men's house, I returned to the north shore. Keiko and the white men had gone back to the larger boat beyond the ice, but promised to return in the morning. I felt sad and exhausted. I watched the sea and listened to the waves and wind, but their voices could not quiet my unhappiness. Though warm within my parka, I started trembling. I could not control myself. The first time such shivering had seized me was one summer when the other boys had asked me to go swimming in the shallow depression in the mountain's flat top. I had swum there before, but suddenly the thought of diving into that frigid water had made me quiver. Since then, the fear sometimes gripped me after I had been out in the boat all day. I would gaze across the waves and suddenly start shivering. It was a terrible feeling. I had not even told Father about it. Respect the sea, he had taught me, and it will give you fish and furs. Tremble before it, and you will drown trembling. Since his disappearance, the fear came almost daily. I slapped at my upper arms and sides, trying to increase circulation. The trembling continued. Cold, Palooknack? Angamachik came up beside me. He looked at me closely, then quickly removed a mitten, put his hand inside my hood, next to my cheek. You're sweating, my friend, and you look flushed. Are you ill? My eyes betrayed me. Frightened, he said. He glanced towards the sea. Well, so am I. The dogmen are evil. He put his arm across my shoulders, and I, Angamachik, alone, if necessary, shall stop them. Look, he pointed towards the shore. There, stepped out in the snow, was a footprint coil. To make one, you walk in an ever-decreasing spiral, always to the left, usually to fool your friends. You then walk backwards, careful not to make new prints. It looks as if you've disappeared. A child's game, but not always for children. Sometimes you do disappear. Friendly spirits snatch you from the coil's center and fly you to the top of the mountain. I've never seen it done, but they say that in the old days it was common. Back then, snow designs were more important to us than they are now. We are a people who like beautiful things and who make beautiful things. Ivory carvings, wood carvings, stone carvings, beadwork, dance clothing. For me, designs in the snow are the loveliest. Like our people, they grace the ground for a short time, then are quickly erased by the elements. People treat them as a child's game now, but my father used to tell me how they once were considered among our greatest creations. Whoever had created this snow coil had done so with care and love. Each footprint precisely placed, each spiral an equal distance from the others. I made that, Angamachik said. I could fly upward, and the spirits would advise how best to destroy the whites. The spirits lifted you? I asked, awed. He gazed at the ground. Not this time, but soon. The spirits will teach me how to kill the whites. Then they'll listen. Who will listen? I asked. Our people or the spirits? Both. When I kill the whites, all will know the power of Angamachik. He strode back towards the village. As I watched him go, my shivering suddenly increased. How my friend could speak so easily of murder dumbfounded me. Violence is not the way of our people. But now, since the world had tipped, the clouds parted. I started walking backwards, ever more quickly, as green and gold ribbons of light wavered across the sky. The colors pulsed and flickered until the night was awash with auroras. The spirits were laughing, laughing at me, surely, laughing at the foolish, trembling, fatherless boy. My shivering turned to anger. I shook my fists at the spirits. You ghost lights, who have laughed every night since father disappeared. You, who play across the sky while the world tips. You, who would teach my friend Angamachik to violate human law. I whistled in mockery as loudly as I could, and wheeled and ran, crunching through the snow. The light spun down, furling and whipping around me. A green and gold whirlpooling wind surrounded me, buffeting my parka. Mad voices laughed and cried in my ears. I dived towards a boulder, hoping to hide. The lights swooped after me. Snow flew up. What felt like cold, clammy hands touched my cheeks, then seized my throat. I screamed and slapped at the lights, desperately looking towards the village. Mother, help me! The village was further away than before. Somehow, I'd gotten turned around. I had run the wrong way. Before me was Angamachik's footprint coil. The auroras flew away for a moment, then came rushing and swirling back, shrieking and cackling. No way could I fight off this new attack. The spirits would choke me and cut off my head. Then who would hunt and fish for mother? I stepped into the coil, careful not to make new prints. Maybe Angamachik's power would save me. Maybe the auroras wouldn't go where a shaman's son had walked. Maybe the coil held power, but the gods had frowned at Angamachik's anger and hatred. I reached the coil's center. The ghost lights followed me, their spirit colors wound around my throat like a too tight scarf. I struggled, gasping. Suddenly, warm and invisible hands lifted me, flying up. Up towards the mountaintop I soared. Around me, the auroras rippled and furled as they searched for me. Below, the village grew ever smaller. Then, the mountaintop was also below me. Set me down! In anguish, I batted at the invisible hands. Air, only air, I felt nothing. The mountaintop spun away below me, and was lost in thrashing light. The sky was ablaze as I passed above the auroras. Below was a sea of beribboned light beneath sparkling stars. The unseen hands released me. I fell sideways, landing with a huff on a circular patch of brown. I sat up, trying to catch my breath, anxious with fear. Blues, yellows, greens, golds churned around me, waves against a beach. I was on some kind of tiny island amid the auroras. The ghosts howled from within the waves, but they were waiting and wailing from anger for my having escaped them, or delight for my being imprisoned on the island. I rose and squinted across the sea of light. Through the silvery dimness, I could see another island. A figure in a bearded seal parka stood and started waving his arms. His parka hood was thrown back and his black hair shone in the starlight. "Hello, the other island," the man called. "Father," I cried out, "is it you?" "Palooknak, yes, Father, yes!" I screamed. My face was hot with excitement, and I jumped up and down in joy. Father stretched out his arms and started dancing like a bear. 44 days alone," he shouted, "and now my son comes to me." Then the waves sloshed near my feet, and my heart sank. My father so close, yet so far. The spirit sea separated us. I'll swim to you, he called. He began stripping off his parka. Have you weapons and food? I called. He waved his hand. A little food, and my spear. He lifted it. Then I'll come to you, father. It wasn't just the weapons and food, though, that made me want to attempt the crossing, nor the thought of being with father. The trembling had again seized me. If I feared the sea more than I loved my father, then I wasn't fit to be called a man. I wasn't fit to sleep in the Kaskig if we ever reached home again. Got to be brave, I told myself as I took off my parka to test the spirit sea. I placed the coat in the water. The sealskin gleamed as watery green light cascaded over it. When I withdrew the coat, it was as dry and cold as death. I shuddered. Be brave. Hugging my parka, I dived among ghosts. I started to feel sick as the cold and clammy light engulfed me. But then I realized I was floating and I opened my eyes. The coat helped buoy me up. I splashed forward through vari-colored currents. Go back, ghost voices sang and whispered, or else give in to your fear and let yourself drown. My arms grew tired. My legs began to ache. The more I thrashed onward, the farther Father's Island seemed to be. Wavelets of freezing light washed over me. The cold pierced me. I became numb. My whole body cried out in pain. How much farther? How much farther? I lifted my head between waves and saw that Father was as distant as ever. I groaned. Let yourself drown, Palukneck. We auroras will shelter you. I kicked and stroked forward. My blood felt frozen. I couldn't make it. I couldn't. I took another stroke. Couldn't go any farther. Another stroke. Another. Then hands were beneath my arms, and they were not the hands of ghosts. Father pulled me onto his island. I sputtered, coughing, and smiled up at him, smiling down. He held my head against his chest and rocked me as though I were yet a babe. My Palukneck, come to me after 44 days, he said. When I sat up, I was trembling, but not from fear. I was trembling from exhaustion. I was very happy. The spirit waves tossed and crashed against the tiny island's shore, perhaps angry that I had escaped the sea. We feared you were dead, Father, I told him as I put on my parka. But Mother and I never believed it, not for a moment. He smiled. One of his front teeth was broken, and his smile seemed to go back into his mouth. He looked gaunt. The skin was taut against his cheekbones, like when Mother is sewing and her bone needle is about to pop through the leather. I was out on the ice, but there were no walrus, he said. I decided to walk back to the north shore and climb up after auk eggs. I went up and up, lots of eggs. Then night fell, and the auroras swooped down. I was closer to the top of the mountain than the shore, so I climbed up the rest of the way, trying to find a place to hide. But you know how it is up there, just that shallow place you boys swim in, not even any boulders to hide against. In desperation, I made a footprint coil, thinking the friendly spirits might deliver me back down to the beach. He glanced around. Instead, I ended up here. Then he said, the auroras sure have been acting up lately. Every night this light sea storms. Angamachek says the world has tipped, I told him. He nodded knowingly when I explained about the white men. Then I told him about my friend's vow to kill them. Father's eyes narrowed with anger. "It is not the whites," Engamachuk fears, he said. "He fears change. He fears he won't be important when he's a shaman, that our people won't look to him for answers. Learn from the whites, and we will have the knowledge of two cultures. Follow Angamachik's way, and we will have nothing." He looked across the sea. "Somehow, we must find a way home, my son, before Angamachik destroys our people." "But how?" I asked. "I made a footprint coil and was flown up here," he said. "You did the same. Always up. Now, to get back down..." I looked at his loving eyes and saw the answer. "Reverse the coil," I said. He grinned and took my mittened hand. "A good son and a smart son. Follow my footsteps, Palutnik." I sat behind the circle of elders in the hut. Mother had lit her extra seal oil lamps, and the interior was filled with shadows and warm, homey smoke. Father was closest to me, drawing with a tan hide with a piece of charcoal. Next to him was Captain, smoking a bowl pipe and watching the drawing studiously. Sometimes Keiko would interrupt, jabbering in the ugly language the whites speak. Captain would nod and point to the drawing. Father was showing where Captain could and could not hunt. We would not lose our hunting grounds. We would not starve. Father would see to that. Each time Captain's boat came here, Father himself would be allowed aboard to help Captain get walrus and whale. In exchange, we would receive food and metal harpoon heads and blankets and wood for our homes. No more foolish trading. I looked across the room and Mother smiled from her place in the corner near the lamp. Her husband was home, and her son a man. No ox crazy danced anymore, and when the auroras did storm, they were gentle light storms, happy storms. Next to her shone the seal gut window. A dark figure loomed outside, obviously trying to peer within. I went to the door. It was Angamachik. His face was cloudy, and the power was gone from his eyes. "Can I come in and watch?" he asked. "Father said no," I told him. "But someday you'll understand, and you too shall be an elder. Both of us, my friend. Soon." We continue with a story from the May 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Recon Man in the City by Felix C. Gottschalk. In Old York Megalop, as throughout most of the planet Earth, photosynthesis and nitroglycerin cyclicity had triumphed over pollution, and the earth once again wept pure tears and exhaled clean vapors. It had taken about 300 years, but now the Hudson and East rivers were pure and sparkling. A baobab tree grew in Times Square. Central Park was a lush rainforest, and the World Trade Towers were marvelously encased, networked, even connected with kudzu up to the 40th story. The skyline stood etched in incredibly clear, stereoscopic clarity against the depthless blue sky as the sun boomed up in fiery brilliance. The silence that lay over the city was cottony in its insulation, and yet germinative, pregnant, humid, expectant, prehistoric. Then, from the topmost layer of a camphor grove in Central Park came the grating scream of a macaw, and half a million starlings came awake and lifted from their perches, filling the air with a macrocosmic fluttering that beat a muted message across the luxuriant jungle park. At the base of the ivy-covered statue by the Rockefeller Center ice skating rink A lioness stirred, and a deep timbre growl rattled in her throat. Beneath the rich earthen carpet on which she lay was a maze of ancient freon tubes in the floor of the skating rink, and beneath that, subterranean tunnels, ducts, shafts, caverns, subways, and conduits, all burgeoning with fungi, lichens, and white moss. The stone and metal city was cocooned in foliage and filled with animals and birds. Late in that summer day, the thunderheads boiled up in the west, and silent blooms of lightning filled the clouds like incandescent lamps in fog. Daryl 14 stirred, awoke, and saw that a kudzu trendle had encircled his ankle during the 12 hours he had been asleep. Teddy H. Kennedy on a styrofoam crutch, he muttered, his favorite ancient epithet, and sat up on the gelatinous chaise. Outside the open window of his squatter's rights billet on the 14th floor of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, his anti-grav flitter hung in its stasis field, the delta stab fuselage veined over with small, fresh, moving kudzu feelers. Daryl was a nomad cartographer, a cloned humanoid, 87% bionic and programmed for reconnaissance and historicity functions. The duchies of the four quads of the old United States each had their own recon history people, and an implicit function of all of them was to develop bases for cooperative sociologic networking. However, territoriality continued to run instinctively deep, even in bionic organisms, and the pattern for at least the past two centuries had been one of inbred territories. Consequently, the few thousand Islamics in the far California quad wanted nothing to do with the strident black chieftains of the southeast quad, the silent manufacturing robots of the Midwest, or the elite bionic Nordics of the northeast. Daryl examined himself in the mirror. Compact, mesomorphic body, gently bulging topographic implants on his torso, two bright, multifaceted visual agates, overly splayed olfactory slits, petal-like lip lines, and a full set of dentures, stronger than those of many of the carnivorous animals with which he shared the largely abandoned city. In physiognomy, he looked like a strong-jawed Elton John mannequin. The women tended to look like Bo Derek Hefner. Daryl capsulized his chaise, tucked it into his thoracic niche, walked across the damp ancient Persian rug to the window, and slid into the flitter. "Another day, another packet of protein dregs," he sighed as the flitter came active, lifting off and away from the foliaged walls. A funnel cloud of striped mosquitoes sang its frenzied song nearby as he coded in the flight pattern, a cross-hatched coverage flight that would aid to the cartography holograms he had been recording for the past week. Like aerial sonar, the lasers on the flitter beamed down and charted the depths and declivities, the redoubts and the spires, the deep canyons of Wall Street, all the mottled green rooftops, the towers and the antennas, the skylights and elevator housings, the copter pods and flagpoles, and the cameras whirred and clacked out their high-resolution photo holo cubes. Sound patterns were also recorded. The audile sensors could code in and separate the hiss of a monitor lizard from the crash of a rusted girder. Daryl was at low altitude above a softly crumbling tenement area when humanoid presence flashed on a control panel. Looking starboard, down over the trailing edge of the silver wing and eclipsing his visual agates to 10 power mag, Daryl saw a Cheryl Ladd figure waving at him from a rooftop deck. He belayed the recon matrix and dipped down to skim over the ancient Puerto Rican ghetto buildings. The girl's flitter was tethered to a chimney stack, and she was brushing her fine golden hair with a glowing wand. He read the receptivity aura she projected, tethered his flitter, and went to her. "Barbara Nine," the girl said. Daryl gave his name, and they embraced ventral, ventral. The genital areas touched, adhered, tight-locked, and they exchanged centile 87 orgasms, a routine initiatory heterosexual salute. "That was heavenly," the girl sighed, brushing her aminoplast lips past Daryl's nasal ports, cueing in her DNA sight. "So quick, so biting, so poignant. Thank you." "And my gratitude to you, beautiful one," he said. "Are you from the Albany Center?" "Yes, I'm new on the route, fresh out of rookie school." She touched Daryl's senior-level epaulets in a nice body language sweep of playful deference. "Shall we shelter together? The storm's coming fast." The bulbous thunderheads towered high above the rooftop, like a canyon wall studded with undulated mammalian globes, and the thunder now seemed to boom in from all around them. Everything darkened, and the rain began to fall, heavily and yet silently, as if the large rainbow-hued drops were of some soft yet heavy substance. Daryl got his EnviroDial kit from the flitter and quickly materialized a small dome over them. He coated in plush epithelial carpeting, a dual chaise, medial luminescence, a Mozart flute sonata, and two vials of Metaxa. "Ethel H. Kennedy and her dozen brats," the girl said. "Me drinking Metaxa is a little like a robot drinking corrosives." And she drank the fierce anisette brandy down. Daryl drank and felt the bouquet fill his sinus caverns and nudged at the back of his eye cubes. "Liquid fire," he said, "keeps the throat seared clean." The recon man and the recon girl lay beside each other on the chaise, counter-coded erogenous zones, and activated a 30-minute centile 94 orgasmic regimen. They lay back and exchanged samplings of life script as the program built up slowly, broadening, deepening, differentiating. The Mozart sonata had no climactic finale, but its serenity served to reinforce the parasympathetic clarity of the bonded, pyrolated orgasm that wielded the two young people together for 38.27 seconds of paroxysmal staging, cresting, contracting, and firing. Their shared moments of expulsive, ingestive joy coincided with lightning knocking a stone gargoyle from the pediment of St. Patrick's Church. But neither knew of this, safe and interlocked in the private life space of the small dome. "When you come to the end of a perfect day," Daryl began to sing, facetious, non-contextual, free-floating in the afterglow. And then he sat up, alert, intent, on guard, his territorial sensors reading threat. Outside, on the steaming, hot-washed, softly collapsed roof, a mutant gladiator clone stalked and circled the dome. The figure was cruelly muscled, turnip-headed, ham-handed, with a strong musk scent of threat emanating from him, his axillary ports like wet chankers. He prodded the dome with his steel truncheon like a child teasing an animal, then sniffed at it, jumping back, primevally fearful but holistically destructive. "A rover glad," Daryl whispered to Barbara, opting for penetrative vision and olfacting the scent. "Do you have a phaser on you?" The girl looked dismayed. "It's in the flitter, on a rack, Oh, we'll both get demerits, Darrell said. I left mine in the rack, too. How could a senior recon man do a dumb thing like that? Barbara suddenly sounded cold and angry, her kittenish warmth gone. You live with your phaser. It's supposed to be part of your hip. Darrell was angered by the girl's taunting voice, but he knew where to cathect his efforts. You want a bitch, or you want to save your ass? His voice came through at a quiet command level, and the girl responded with military resignation fired by survival dynamics. Listen now. You peel naked and pulse your umbilical zircon at him. I'll need about 5 seconds to get my phaser. My guess is he won't know what to do for at least 30. Then he'll want to stalk you and sniff at you. Are you up to it? No options, Barbara said. Just don't let him touch me. Gun him down quick. Darrell visuoed through the dome and saw the Glad hunkered down, sniffing at the fine geodesic mesh of the structure, his nostrils flaring rhythmically like the radial undulations of a lamprey's mouth. Get behind the chaise, Darrell said. That'll be a barrier to him if he rushes. Ready? Barbara tensed and nodded. Darrell had the immediate problem in the forefront of his mind, but he was also wondering how he would deal with the consequences of having left his phaser in the flit. It was as bad as a duelist showing up on a foggy Dawn Park lawn without the brace of flintlocked pistols. He dematerialized the dome in one soft pop, bellowed a roar at the Glad, and sprinted for the flitter, the crust of the tar roof yielding and weak beneath his light levitational boots. The Glad reacted in a flash, scuttled to intercept him, and then stopped, set his feet, and drew his truncheon back for a carefully leveraged throw. As he raised his long, hairy arm, Barbara screamed at him, invoking a startled response. Distracted now from Darrell, the Glad watched as Barbara's belly zircon glowed and pulsed like the energy eye of a furnace. The gladiator lowered the truncheon and drank in the rare sight, a centile 92 biohuman female in a posture of sexual receptivity. The girl's scent flooded his olfactory centers, sent itching hormonal messages to his pelvic cradle, and his serrated penile shaft began to emerge like the head of a Galapagos turtle. His breathing came in airy grunts, and as he began to lurch towards her, Darrell stunned him to the roof with his phaser. The Glad stiffened in the force cone and fell, as if struck a hard blow from above. The microcephalic head broke through the tar crust of the roof like a bowling ball on soft ice. Now, Darrell and Barbara became aware of the profound silence, the gentle, wet wind, the humid sweetness of the air, and the distant chorus of bird calls. Barbara averted her head and fluxed on her clothing sheaf as Darrell notched the phaser to sear and incinerated the body. The roof caught fire and the body lowered out of sight, the blackened rib cage looking like iron buttresses in the roof of some massive industrial building. Darrell got the feeling that the skeletal structure was indeed made of steel. The city is by definition ugly, Darrell said to Barbara as they flew in tandem towards the data bank reporting station atop the Empire State Building. Ugly in the sense of that most ancient relationship, prey and predator. The giant spider eats the bird-wing butterfly, Barbara sighed. Yet the horned caterpillar looks formidable on the citrus leaf. And the chrysalis still hides from us the mystery of metamorphosis. And who preys on us, my stalwart bionic peer? Barbara now sounded cheerful and supportive. The Glads try to, Darrell laughed, relieved by the tone in Barbara's voice. He knew that they're both forgetting to wear their phasers required mutual reporting and was feeling his way for some alternative. Recon personnel had been wiped and reprogrammed for lesser offenses. They lapsed into silence as they flew low over eucalyptus-choked Park Avenue. As the tandem flitters arced up towards the peak of the Empire State, other flitters appeared in varying flight patterns, each carrying their cartographic samples of the ancient crumbling city. Darryl turned to Barbara, asking the question on both their minds. I don't want to turn you in over the phaser thing. You gonna turn me in? Barbara's face was at first affectedly stern, her eyes penetratingly severe, and then her expression softened and she kissed him quickly, impulsively. No, no, she said, as if her spoken words were insects to be batted away from her sweet, sweated brow. My responses are flexible yet. I couldn't report you. Darryl relaxed and gunned the flit into a recovery niche atop the 86th floor parapet. Thank Teddy H. Kennedy for the 13% of our bodies that is still humanoid, he laughed. But it was a strained laugh. We're 87% bionic and 13%, what should we call that part of us, that remaining percentage? Kindliness, Barbara said quietly. We can still be kind to each other. Funny how nobody uses that word anymore, Darryl said. Maybe to be kind is evolutionarily maladaptive. Well, it feels good to me, Barbara said, stepping out onto the smooth stone observation deck where millions of people had stood to look out over the spire-studded narrow rock island that was Old York. The deck began to fill with the other recon people, and a provost sled arrived, its two slate-gray robots debarking like frogmen from a raft. Yeah, kindliness, Darryl said, letting the word filter through his human-eyed soul. I like the way it feels, too. As the great spherical sun set in the rain-washed western sky, the senior recon man and the plebe recon girl took their places in the gathering line, feeling, for the moment at least, adaptively kind and at ease. They slotted their sample cases into the computer breech and turned to walk towards the flitters. They were about to join hands when the Provobot's phaser stunned them to the hard stone surface. Nobody paid much attention to the scene. It happened almost every day. The robots carried Darryl and Barbara as if they were light as feathers, placing them in coffin-like structures on the air sled. Huh, another brace of 87%ers, one of the robots muttered as the sled lifted off. When will they ever learn that they were always on camera, always monitored, always taped? What did they do? The other robot asked, looking through the coffin surfaces at their serene faces. Forgot to carry phasers, came near getting killed by a GLAD, and then agreed not to report it. Ronald H. Reagan, the robot gave his favorite ancient epithet. That's a dangerous 13% to leave hanging for volitional acts. 2 weeks at the implant farm and they'll be 94%ers, no problem. What's that they said on the audios? Kindliness, was it? Lyndon H. Johnson, the robot muttered the strongest ancient epithet of all. I'd be dog if I know what that means. The other robot made allowance for the old Faulknerian saying, and his linguistic banks clacked onto nonverbal. The sled flew into the gloriously primeval sunset with the two as yet imperfect biohumans peacefully unconscious in their crypts. Somehow, their faces looked kind. We conclude with a poem from the November 1986 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Epicenter by Robert Fraser. A faint rumble. The desk shakes. An echo. Adrenalized, my hands falter above the Apple keyboard and begin to enter a new line. A faint rumble. The desk shakes. It's as if earthquakes follow the physics in a bubble chamber where atoms are altered or decayed. I collapsed from balancing my checkbook into this poem, this echo. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.